You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. We talk a lot about immigration on this show. After all, immigrants bring food, techniques, and recipes with them and enrich our lives with the flavor of their homeland. We often touch on their stories, but don't tell enough of them in depth. Writer and photographer Lisa M. Hamilton has documented agriculture and rural communities around the world. With her latest book, The Hungry Season, she documents one Hmong woman's struggle to survive war, loss, and displacement while she holds on to the identity that centers her. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Evan. It's good to be back on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you back. Could you introduce us to Ia Mua, the extraordinary woman at the center of your book? How did you come to meet her and to decide to follow her in such depth?
Ia Mua is an extraordinary woman who grows rice in Fresno, California. Anyone who's been to Fresno, California knows that growing rice there is an extraordinary act to begin with, because it's just about the opposite of your average rice growing environment. But the specialness of Ia goes way beyond her rice growing. She's a portrait of resilience.
Her journey begins in Laos. How were Hmong people generally treated in Laos?
Well, they are technically an ethnic minority, the largest ethnic minority in Laos, but they were latecomers to Laos. They're Hmong are originally from China and migrated largely in the past 200 years via Vietnam into Laos. And as a result, they tend to occupy the highest elevations in this mountainous country, so generally the poorest land. And for a long time after their arrival, they really occupy the lowest strata on the social ladder. And that's changed in recent decades as they've gained political power and social organization within the country. But they still, in some ways, particularly because of their history during the Civil War, can be treated as pariahs in Laos.
Laos is also a country that's been ripped apart both by the American presence in Southeast Asia and by internal conflicts. What was her life like there, and what precipitated her family's move out of the country?
Well, you know, most Americans know about what we call the Vietnam War, but far fewer know that at the same time as the war in Vietnam, there was a parallel conflict happening really in tandem in Laos, which is just over the border to the west. And Ia was born during this conflict, some would say at the time that it really renewed and then escalated from there until when she was 15 years old, she escaped the country. When she was 13, the battle between really capitalism and communism was won by the communists, and those who had allied with the Americans in the conflict had to either hide, submit, leave, or face the danger of this new communist rule that was seeking them out with a vengeance.
You have an incredibly powerful moment in the book where you describe the kind of scrambling of the family's decision what to do and how she is actually given a choice of who to follow, her parents or her brothers.
Yes, imagine Ia as an 11-year-old girl in 1975 when the war finally definitively ended and the Hmong leader of the, at that point, resistance fled to Thailand. Ia and her family and the rest of the Hmong people who had allied with the Americans suddenly had to face the choice of whether to stay and try and wait out what seemed like a pretty dark future or to leave. Most of Ia's family rushed toward the border with Thailand, but her father and her mother and her youngest brother turned around after just a day because they thought it was a doomed journey. Her brothers continued on because they were young and they had fought for the Hmong leader, General Vang Pao, and it was obvious that they would be targeted by the new regime. Ia lay in between. So this 11-year-old girl is given the choice, do you want to try to make it to Thailand or do you want to go home? And it's this first moment when we realize this is an extraordinary person and will inside of her, because she says, you know what? I think I'm going to make it. I think I'm going to be one of the lucky ones to make it through all of the barriers. And so she goes.
How long does it take before Ia arrives in Fresno, and where has she spent most of that time?
You can imagine that Ia is leaving Laos not alone, but alongside 100,000 Hmong, other Hmong from Laos, and that's just the Hmong. There are also a Lao people coming over, other ethnicities, as well as Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees, all streaming into Thailand, and many of them hoping to end up in the United States. Ia and her family ended up staying in a refugee camp in Thailand for 15 years. So she arrived as a 15-year-old and left as a 30-year-old woman with 8 children.
Wow. So why Fresno? How did this Central California city become such a hub for Hmong people living in the United States?
Well, the American government, in accepting refugees from its conflicts in Southeast Asia, had the initial strategy of trying to disperse these refugees all over the country so they would just sort of assimilate. So they replaced, through aid organizations with sponsors, all over the country. But Hmong life centers on the community. So assimilation, immediate assimilation, was uncomfortable. And it ended up really not being an option. Instead, Hmong within the United States, many of them chose to do a sort of secondary migration following clan leaders to places that became hubs. Today, Minneapolis and St. Paul is a particular hub, probably the largest Hmong population in the United States, Wisconsin, and so on. But early on, Fresno became a hub for a variety of reasons, chief among them that Fresno is the sort of capital of the agricultural valley that runs down the center of California. And a lot of Hmong moved there thinking they might be able to restart their lives as farmers. Of course, farming in Fresno is a far cry from farming in the mountains of Laos, as many of them found out, and the vast majority of Hmong who moved to Fresno were not able to enter this sort of capitalized agriculture that dominates in Fresno.
So how was Ia and her family able to do that? How did they find land to farm? How did they begin that process?
Well, in a word, they were able to do it because of Ia and the resolve that's really at the core of her character. When she came to the United States, she found that because she didn't speak English, she was relegated to farm work. And this didn't suit her. She's an alpha, not a follower in any means. So she began as a farm worker, but she was offered a little strip of land by a relative. And the relative said, do you want to grow rice? Ia didn't even know that this was possible in California, but she immediately said yes, because it was an opportunity to grow this particular kind of rice, not so much to grow rice sort of for the year for the everyday meal, but to grow it for this one particular meal that comes at the end of the harvest season. It's this single meal during the year that is hard to live without. And she had lived without it for so long in the refugee camp and before that during the aftermath of the war and during the war when they weren't able to farm rice. And so she jumped at the chance. And from, you know, just a few rows on a farm, she got this hunger for more. And she, over the years, grew that into 2, then 4, and ultimately 10 acres in Fresno, where she grew a variety of things, but ultimately grows 4 acres of rice by hand. If you can imagine, that's several football fields worth with no machinery at all. It's an extraordinary amount of work.
And does this rice stay in the community? Is it commodified at all?
This rice is a hot commodity. I don't think there's ever been a year when she hasn't sold out. It has shifted from being, you know, a sort of subsistence level growing of a staple food to growing a very special commodity of sorts that is sold exclusively to the Hmong community. It's prepared in such a way that it holds a very particular and very precious meaning to the Hmong community. So, it's interesting. I've did the numbers over the years, and I found that people will pay 3 to 5 times as much for this rice as they would for rice in a store. A 5-gallon bucket, last time I checked, was going for close to $200. Every year she sells out, people start calling a month before it's even ready, trying to get in line to buy it.
So Eef fixed on this particular variety of rice and it became her lifeline. Can you read a few paragraphs for us that describe her relationship to it?
Sure. They call this particular rice Ble Nia Tai, grandmother rice. Some say it's named for the person it came from. The farmer got the seed from her brother, who got it from a friend, who got it from his wife, who got it from her mother. That mother has a name, but no one would have used it since before she was married. As an old woman, she would just be called grandmother, grandmother's rice. Others say that the rice was given this name because it yields so much, taking care of you with its bounty the way a grandmother's love softens the sharp edges of life. And it's true, this year all the farm's rice grew tall and thick, but none like the grandmother rice. In mid-October, when the wands of ripe grain have bowed under their own weight and curved back down toward the earth, the arc of the grandmother rice is taller than anyone on the farm. Below, its long, sword-shaped leaves have plaited together in such a tangle that the spaces between rows disappear. Entering this thicket, the farmer must first push with her shoulder, then draw her arms through, as if opening a heavy door. As she passes inward, the vegetation rejoins behind her. Were she to release herself and fall backward, the grandmother rice would hold her up. When the farmer is enclosed like this, the only view is straight up to the blank blue sky. The road running alongside the field disappears. The din of traffic fades. As the honeyed fragrance of rice fills her head, she can imagine herself back to the place of her memories. The village where she was born was swallowed up by the jungle in the years after the war, but it is still alive in her mind. All around are steep mountains shrouded in clouds. The village itself is level, set amid gentle green hills with blue skies above. It is never too hot there, never too cold. The air is sweet with sugarcane, the land thick with wild fruit trees. Every morning, a choir of birds. Even today, 40 years later, standing in this grandmother rice can transport her back to there. It's almost as if she could reach into the tangle of leaves and touch her parents, close to her once again. An orphan, no more.
So beautiful. The prose of this book is just so wonderful. Where is Iyamua today?
Well, she's still in Fresno. She's still on the farm. She's farming a little less than she used to, and she's now farming only rice. But she's still there, and I think she'll be there for the rest of her life. You know, over time, I have spoken with so many farmers in so many different places, so many different kinds of farms, and most of them talk about how farming is essential for them. It's the only thing they can imagine themselves ever doing. With Iya, that dedication, that centrality of farming to who she is and what her purpose is, it's like no one I've ever met. I can't imagine Iya not farming. It's almost like she and her rice have become sort of intertwined.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. It's just such a marvelous book, very powerful.
Oh, Evan, thank you so much. I'm really glad you liked it.
That was Lisa Hamilton. Her book is The Hungry Season, a journal of war, love, and survival. If you're going to read a book over the next few weeks, I urge you to choose this one. You'll find a link to it on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, how a unique friendship spawned the first English language cookbook of Hmong recipes. Stay with us.